This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good morning and welcome back to The Morning Run. I'm Roshan Kanesan, and with me in studio this morning is Wong Xiaoning. In about 15 minutes, we'll be taking a look at this year's top healthcare stories in Malaysia. And to that effect, we've got a poll on Twitter right now. How would you grade the Health Ministry's performance for 2019? You've got until 9 a.m. to reply to this poll. And right now, we've got about 15 voters in, and it's looking rather positive. Almost 50 to 60% have replied in favor of good or excellent, which is, I think, quite reflective. I think this is one of the ministries that's performed on the better side since GE14.
A lot of announcements, actually, with regards to reforming the healthcare sector. They have been rather proactive, I guess, in the last 20 months. Good for them, because, you know, I think if anything, our healthcare system needs a definite overhaul. Some of the legislation has been in place in the last 20 years with very little changes.
And Dr. Zul was, I think, the first minister to come on to the breakfast grill after the last election, which was a very insightful conversation.
We would like to have him again.
Oh, for sure. And I think next week, they're going to have their next big challenge, which is the enforcement of the smoking ban that they implemented, that they spearheaded. So it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. But right now, let's take a look at the markets. It was a quiet trading season in the US due to the shortened Christmas Eve session. The markets held on to gains that have made this year the best year for equity since 2013, which is in quite a contrast to the turmoil that was going on 1 year ago, where markets took a fantastic dip down under. And traders on Wall Street ended the day early on the before Christmas to mark the holiday, with markets closing half day at 1 p.m.
Yeah, the Nasdaq finished up the day 0.1%, setting a new record and capping 10 straight days of gains, matching its best run since the summer of 2017 and returning 35% so far this year. Now, the S&P 500 closed the day flat. The benchmark returned 28.6% so far this year, not far from the 29.6% annual gain we saw in 2013. And 3% of 1997. Now, rises were led by blue chips, including chipmaker AMD, which was boosted by a broker update. Only the Dow closed 0.1%. But if even on a year-to-date, the benchmark has returned 22.2%. So it looks like we are enjoying a bit of a Santa rally.
Yeah, and that was actually 31% in 97. That was the gain that they saw back then. So some massive gains in the last 1 year. And I think anyone who sold off a year ago is feeling a bit down right now. But the Santa rally, as we're apparently calling it, is fueled by the fact that investors were more positive once the Fed started looking a bit more dovish. And we've seen three cuts over the last year, quite a stark contrast. And for more on global markets and where it could go, and basically a better look at Asia, we have on the line with us Vishnu Varathan, Head of Economics and Strategy over at Mizuho Bank. Vishnu, welcome to the show, and a merry belated Christmas. What were the best performing currencies in the emerging markets this year?
Well, you know, we've got an Asian entry in that list. The best performing EM currency on record is the Russian ruble, but the Thai baht has performed exceptionally well. It's up almost 8% for the year. And you've got, it's a far cry, and it's a contrast to the renminbi, which is down almost 2%. So the Thai baht is by a long shot the best performing currency that we've seen. It's followed by the Philippine peso and the Indonesian rupiah in Asia. But generally, the currencies have been somewhat more subdued than the equity markets you're speaking about earlier this year.
And you had a duck team running through your latest FX report. Looking ahead to 2020, which EM currencies do you expect to rally? And conversely, which will face higher risk sentiments? And why the use of the word duck?
Well, I think, you know, Christmas we all get hung up on the turkeys, and I thought, you know, so poor thing, the ducks need a bit of airplay, don't they? I mean, there are two things about it. One is, I think one of the themes you wanted to put across was exactly what you're talking about. You know, equities had a blistering rally. Markets seem to be very buoyant, center rally, or no matter what we name it. And we said, you know, actually the markets are a bit like a duck. They look quite placid on the surface, a very benign environment if you look at it on the surface. But beneath, they're pedaling furiously, and we're trying to duck in terms of averting. We're trying to duck risks along the way, be it Brexit, be it your US, China, and to the question of which EM currencies will perform best in 2020, it really depends which risks we happen to duck and how we line up the ducks, I suppose. Our sense is that if you do get an improvement in the US-China trade space, and given that the semiconductor outlook is improving on the memory chips, definitely. On the processing chips, it looks a bit more tentative. But if all of that comes through, we think the Korean won has got a huge potential to outperform, given its staggering underperformance this year. It was one of the worst performing Asian currencies. The overhang right now is from an economic risk, it shifts to geopolitical risks around the Korean Peninsula, which is much harder to call. So that makes our job a little bit more difficult. And in all honesty, I think the Thai baht is trying to duck getting further strength, particularly given that they are also exports driven and they don't want too much Thai baht strength. And also the tourism is hurt by the Thai baht strength as well. And I think our overall sense is that even if we think rates are going to be lower for longer, we cannot assume that EM Asian currencies will get to benefit endlessly from the so-called carry trades, because on a relative basis, dollar interest rates are pretty high compared to Eurozone or yen. So there's always that chance that the dollar remains firmer than we give it credit for.
Now, looking ahead at your GDP forecast, Vishnu, all economies in Asia except China show a pickup in growth for 2020 and 2021. So what's going to hold back the Chinese economy next year?
I think the broad answer to that question is it's the Chinese economy itself that's going to hold itself back. The reason for all the other Asian economies is because they're coming from a low base. We expect exports to start picking up, even if not at a blistering pace, to recover. And so we see a gentle pickup, certainly not a V-shaped recovery, but something more towards a U-shaped recovery. For China, I think it's structural factors. Your aging demographics, a more expensive workforce, and industries that were already leaving before the trade war were already bleeding out into Vietnam. What adds to that is that China is still stuck between deleveraging and trying to boost growth, and so they can't achieve both. And for those reasons, they're going to end up getting slightly softer growth, but a very managed slowdown rather than a crash.
And Vishnu, what are the overall risk factors to your regional outlook then?
I mean, for one, we, when I say we, I mean I remain a huge pessimist on US-China. I mean, I think on the surface you get the phase one deal rolled out, and there are two problems with it. The first problem is where to from a rather shallow phase one, and a very and it was almost like pulling teeth getting those things in. And let's recall that the tariff rollback was only 10% of what was imposed was rolled back. So it's really scratching the surface of it. It's really the iceberg, the 10% above. What I'm worried about is, do we get progress from there? And the bigger aspect is that the tech tensions between US and China continue on. And if they clamp down further on Huawei, so on and so forth, the phase one deal really doesn't matter. I think conditions can deteriorate. And as we discussed earlier, there's also a geopolitical aspect, whether in the Middle East or in the Korean Peninsula. We also have got some uncertainties. And while we think that Brexit will be more or less ring-fenced, that risk is re-emerging now that Johnson has put back the hard landing or the hard crash, the crash-out Brexit risk back on the table.
And how might this affect Asian central bank policy? Which central banks do you think will look to cut rates first in the new year?
I think the Philippines is I think in a very good position to cut. Their inflation is very low, and they've got a lot of space too. But we also think Bank Indonesia is also intending to cut, and India, depending on whether they can dampen food inflation, will cut further, despite the fact that they've cut 135 basis points in 2019. Whereas scope to cut remains for BOK and Bank of Thailand. But they may hold back and watch how the trade pickup progresses. So there is certainly an intention and an inclination to ease, but I think the space is getting more limited. So even if these guys want to move, the space too becomes very much more limited as we go into the middle of 2020.
All right. Thank you so much, Vishnu. That was Vishnu Varadhan, Head of Economics and Strategy over at Mizuho Bank. And now looking at other headlines we have, co-founder and former CEO of Uber, Travis Kalanick, is parting ways with the ride-hailing giant. After stepping back as CEO, he is now relinquishing his board seat and his shares. Under Kalanick, Uber turned into an icon of the startup ambition before his ouster back in 2017.
But don't feel sad for him, you know, because he actually has netted $2.7 billion as a result of this. And in a statement, he said that it seems like the right moment for me to focus on my current business and philanthropic pursuits. Yeah, with $2.7 billion, he can have a lot of hobbies now.
Yeah, true. But at the same time, you look at the Uber stock price and it could have been so much more. I mean, it's down 30% now from the time they IPO'd at a valuation of, I think, $80 billion at the time. Now, this exit, Travis leaving Uber, punctuates a decade in which Silicon Valley investors pumped up startups with billions and upon billions of dollars. I think, Xiaoning, you've made your feelings well known about this. And they granted their founders too much vast powers and a mandate to grow at breakneck speeds. It reminds me a lot of what Mark Zuckerberg used to say, move fast and break things, which is a mantra that Travis Kalanick really took to another level. And Uber and Kalanick were architects of this model, and Facebook as well at the time. Kalanick raised over $14 billion in equity and debt from outside investors who bought into him and his vision and his energy back when he was starting at Uber. At its peak, when it was still a startup, they were talking about valuations of $68 billion and they IPO'd at 80-ish.
And now the share price is a nice $30 US. So, how the mighty have fallen. I think the point about this is that, you know, there is a difference between the private and the public market. So, when they were not listed, everyone was like, oh, this is so great. Look at the way they're burning cash. You know, the faster you burn, the faster you grow. Well, guess what? When you come to the public market, that mantra no longer exists. Everyone is going to ask you, when are you going to start making money? And as soon as you can't, this is what happens to your share price. It like halves.
Yeah, and that was also helped by the WeWork IPO, right? When they released their prospectus and people realized that, oh my God, what is this flaming pile of garbage?
Well, it was a tech company. It claimed to be a tech company masquerading as a landlord. So that explained the fact that the IPO never took off, right? Yeah, and there was a complete mismatch between how they charge their clients versus how they have to spend their money. So, you know, at the end of the day, you know, the public market kind is a little bit, I would say, a little bit more discerning. And yet, you can choose, right? Because there's so many listed companies. Why would you choose a company that you don't even know when is going to make its first dollar?
Yeah, and then, you know, this scaling up was what was known as blitz scaling back in the day. Or when I mean back in the day, I mean like 5-6 years ago, where Uber or even WeWork just scaled up without a threat of what it cost. And whether it went against regulations. I mean, Travis was very famous and Uber about not breaking the rules, but walking around the rules to get what they wanted.
I mean, this is all due to the fact that there was so much dry powder, right, in the region with ultra low rates at 1%. This is what you get, you know, you get lots of funds putting money into startups. And he's got, this guy's got a new startup coming out, right, called Cloud Kitchen. So we might see more of him in the next few years.
Yeah, and of course, that culture that permeated the business eventually led to his ouster. There were claims of chauvinism and that his relationship with regulators was going down the drain. And eventually they brought in Dara Khosrowshahi to kind of be the adult in the room. But anyway, we're heading into a few messages after this, and we're going to be talking about the biggest local healthcare stories this year in Malaysia. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.